IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 59 of the Killing It Podcast. I'm Carl. I'm joined today by Dave and Ryan, as usual. Do want to have a remind you of a couple of things. First of all, we have a new reading list, which you've added some things to. And so go check that out at killingit.smallbiztalks.com. And basically, when we mention books primarily, we're going to add them to that list. So please check that out.
Maybe we should have a book club one day.
I actually thought about that because we spend so much time talking about things like the Innovator's Dilemma.
Yeah. All right, listeners, should we have a book club and we just show up? How would you be doing?
Send us the word. Also, a reminder that the SMB Online Conference is May 19th and 20th. So that's coming up next week. Please join us there. If you're interested in more information, go to smbonlineconference.com.
And a quick thing, if you haven't signed up, you want to show, we are doing an episode of this podcast live during the event. If you show up as an attendee, you will get to hear some of our pre-show banter before how we warm ourselves up, and we're going to do an extra topic. So for the you'll still get your regular episode that'll go out, but there'll be an extra topic in the live version.
Bonus material.
So incentive to sign up, everybody.
We call that Killing It Live. So, Ryan, I don't want to spend a lot of time on where you've been because you haven't been anywhere, but you're getting a new standing desk. Tell us about that.
You know, it's in the further spirit of if we're going to be in the home office every day for the rest of forever, might as well make it an ideal environment, right? And I have sold ergonomic solutions and working technologies for many years. And so I decided to, you know, drink my own Kool-Aid here and make some adaptations. Naturally, there's been some shipping delays because of the world, but it finally all arrived, and I will be up and running full time when we do our next recording here with all of the stuff going on. Anyone who's ever known me or seen me, for me to talk while sitting down that's a slightly difficult thing, and it does have the natural ripple effect of way more wild and spastic hand movements with it. So I think that when I can do these kinds of things and actually stand during them, I'm not interested in the physical benefits of that. I think it'll just be a much more natural way to talk to people when we're doing these kinds of things or in a meeting or whatever, a little bit more energy, a little bit more natural. So I went with like as far as you could go into the automation and the multiple height settings. And, you know, if you're a nerd and you're going to get a desk, it's got to have an engine. It's got
to
have.
I worry that you're going to turn around and walk to the other side of the room and just you'll be.
I will wander naturally. I will.
He's going to need a wired mic for these things. If he's
But as you guys also know, that a while back, I also got the under desk exercise bike thingy, right? And I do that when I put myself on mute on conference calls. So I feel like I've got calves of steel and I'm about to have like quads of steel. So maybe this homeworking thing will work out after all.
The funny thing is I tried one of those things and it wouldn't fit under my desk. So I ended up like shoved way far away from my whole desk trying to bike. And I was like, oh, that didn't go.
I'm too old to be reading that far away. So. Alrighty then. So topic number one today, we want to talk about facial recognition, both good and bad. And I've got an article here from Wired Magazine that we're going to point to. And, you know, part of this is, you know, how good can it get when facial recognition has to deal with people with masks on? Which is kind of an interesting thing. We hadn't really expected that bump in the road.
The new fashion statement, your choice of mask, which I only say partly in jest. Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, Apple is already making changes to their Face ID implementation. It's a subtle thing because what they're doing to compensate is that there won't be that pause anymore where Face ID doesn't recognize the button for use passcode will be instantly available, so you don't have to wait. That's their first answer to this, because as the article gets into, there are some privacy concerns as you dig into trying to make it less focused on the entire face and more focused on just the eyes, and just the upper portion of the face. So that will be an upcoming change from the Apple front.
Well, and there was a cliche many years ago, right? You know, people can see the smile in your eyes, and eyes are very expressive, and it is, from a facial recognition point of view, technologically possible to identify a person by their eyes and by the movements of the muscles around the eyes, right? So I have done some reading on this because, you know, again, I don't like to do any additional keystrokes if I don't have to. So I was an early adopter of the facial recognition on the mobile phone platform. And we've discussed it extensively on this in this podcast about the pros and cons from a commercial as well as a security as well as a privacy point of view. I think what people are going to start to realize is that they have willingly given away way more access to their person and their privacy in the spirit of convenience than they realized, because I think that this debate that's going on, you know, like you mentioned, Dave, is it a further invasion and lower accuracy levels, and are we okay with doing it only by the eyes? If you only knew just how much you've already agreed to in terms of having your face recognized, you would be shocked.
The story's not new, right? That we gave up more than we thought we were going to. I think one of the interesting things for me is that is the piece of this that says, well, you know what? It's really mostly accurate on white males followed by white females. And part of that is, as they point out in the Wired article, that NIST, which is our National Institute for Science and Technology, is the international arbiter of the accuracy of facial recognition. So maybe that shouldn't necessarily be a US-centric thing.
I would vote it should not, but I agree with you.
Admittedly, in natural interest, if it's not us, who is it? There is that question.
Well, yeah, you know, we've talked about that duality. The next option is China.
Yeah, the SplinterNet is not just a web browser question, right? Like the SplinterNet and all of the underlying technologies are going to become much more human, and by definition, much more diverse. And so there is a question of effectiveness, but there's also a question of bias based on how it's built in. I think that there are some interesting technological answers to consider there. And it's not like, I mean, I used to say this many, many years ago. The only reason that one application will not share data natively with another application is it's on purpose, right? Proprietary software boundaries are programmed into the software. The fact that a camera will recognize one ethnic group more effectively than another, it's not like you can't recognize every group. It's just that we haven't gone to the trouble of writing the code to cause it to recognize that yet.
Or fed it the data, which is the other piece of it. In some cases, the issue is that we just haven't fed it enough diversified data in order to.
Can it be done? Absolutely. It's just a little bit more expensive. So I think we'll get there.
And the other article that we linked to below is about the police agencies trying to find victims of child abuse and so forth. And how much do we want children's data to be out there? Because someday something might happen to them and then we need to find them. And that's an international cooperation between the United States and Canada, right?
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't highlight the fact that it's Clearview AI. That's some of the piece that's covered in this. And Clearview has its own set of significant ethics problems, particularly the fact that they, you know, violated the terms of services of all of the providers they scraped the data from, and are providing this kind of technology to, you know, wealthy individuals just to play with. I mean, there is some real ethical problems going on there that are for my mind, very clear violations when we talk about ClearView's technology.
Right. And that's the thing is that, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, at least if it's a government, even if it's another government, I can hold them accountable. But if it's a private agency that got funding from private groups and then they just scrape data off the internet, how do I control that? Like, how do I not well.
By the way, as we will learn here, not just in topic one, but also in topic two, ceding pseudo-legal powers to private corporations doesn't usually work out with the beneficial outcomes you think it will. I think that there, you know, as your passport is a government entity issue, I think that your face will become your passport, and that needs to be more centrally regulated and not commercially exploited. Yes, you may have commercial exploits on top of all of that regulated data, but the central control of efficacy and accuracy and all of that stuff, I do believe that for all the best intentions, when somebody has a P&L behind that question, there will be corners cut and there will be profitability questions that trump fairness questions.
Well,
so
absolutely. I mean, look, Gary. I make the argument every time this comes around, and I will make it again because I think it clears it. Look, if you're a chemical company, cheapest disposal method is dump it in the river. it is society that says we like clean water, so you're not allowed to do that. You know, we like that there's a certain simplicity and elegance to saying, oh, well, the market will just solve that. Sometimes that's not true.
Yeah, you show me an industry that has successfully self-regulated, and we can have a conversation. But
you will show me the first ever. Because
exactly. As long as we're halfway there, Dave, why don't you take us into topic number two?
Well, topic number two, then, because this is based on a news story, and it's very timely for the when this episode comes out, it will have been the late part of the previous week. You know, Facebook has made their announcement on the 20 names that make up their body that can essentially overrule Mark Zuckerberg as the oversight board. They can be, you know, you can call them almost the Supreme Court of Facebook. The idea is that they are independent of the company, and they will be the people that come up with the policies around content. And where I wanted to, you know, for me, the instant takeaway was the Facebook is so big and so influential that they are now creating their own system of laws internal to it.
Internationally.
Right, and internationally, that they are creating their own set of laws. And, you know, and so for me, that this really comes to that. I wanted to throw it out for the, well, what do you guys think? and this element of, you know, how do we feel about technology companies in that space of self-regulation and setting up their own systems of legal power, essentially?
To me, one of the interesting pieces when I think about Facebook is always, they have certain areas where they've decided we're not going to go. Like, they have not caved into the Chinese, for example, right? They are resisting the European Union as much as they can, but, you know, they're basically funding the European Union at this point with all the fines that they have. But I think part of it is that they acknowledge that they have to have some responsibility to somebody. They just want to choose who it is. And that's the part that's a little bit, you know, dicey for me. Is like, yes, you can regulate us. These 20 people are going to be that body.
Right? Well, I think one of the things we have learned is that while it might be problematic for any commercial entity to self-govern in questions that are naturally at tension with their business model, I think there's going to be a question there anyway. I think we've all learned for a fact that Facebook is not the entity that should be taken seriously.
Right.
Not one time, not two times, not 200 times, right? Like they've demonstrated that expediency and, well, we just want to have an open conversation and that's, and then they say, oh, well, we'll back that up and we'll have some content filtering people. Well, even if you employ 100,000 content filterers, you will get to 1% of the message flow on their platforms. And then people said, well, it's just too big to be done, so we just won't even bother to do it. Okay, that's a commercial argument, not a social argument. And therefore, I think that it needs to be had beyond their boundaries. But should that stuff be evaluated? I mean, you know, there's this, the debate out there right now is, well, I ought to be able to say whatever I want and those people shouldn't be able to censor me. It's not censorship if it is a commercial platform. It's not a public utility. And by the way, if you would like to be educated as to why Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, are not public utilities and should not be treated that way, ask Facebook. They have some very angry lawyers who are ready and able to just bury you with all the legal briefs in the world about why they are not a public utility and therefore not governed by the First Amendment, and therefore you don't get to say whatever you want on that platform. It's not yet a government question. And the question is, are we okay with that? I think behavior on those systems has proven that it warrants that somebody ought to be overlooking it. And you know, kudos to these guys. The people they've named on this board are some serious adults. Like, this is a grown-up conversation. They didn't just put, you know, five or six guys from Facebook on this group and said, okay, we'll do it. No, they put some legitimate experienced professionals into this conversation. Can you fathom the volume of cases that they would have to adjudicate if they were to get to a representative sample, even to establish policies? It's a public relations ploy at this point. It's not ever going to be, from a Facebook point of view, it's not ever going to be sufficient to scale to their volume.
So the thing I want to tell you, we've now covered two topics, and I want to make it a little bit practical for our audience and say, look, these are actually the issues that you need to think about for both yourself and then understand what your customers impact, you know, how they're impacted by these decisions and also where their heads are at. Because ultimately, you know, it's real easy for us to say, oh, well, this is government. We're all in the business world. No. We're now going through two whole areas of technology that are completely left to a regulatory conversation, much more than it just a raw technology conversation. We talk about the industry maturing. Well, this is part of growing up, is that you then have to take on these kinds of issues. And it's not just a, we can sell our way or the market will solve all of this. Is no, there's issues that are going to have to be regulated, and we've got to have positions and involvement in those regulations.
And some of this is in response to 2016 and in preparation for the election of 2020, you know, how do we regulate speech? How do we regulate, you know, what people can do and say and so forth? And I don't know that, you know, we necessarily want to start letting private organizations determine what constitutes free speech. You know, when you get to be big enough, you do have to respond to something bigger than your customers, right?
Right.
And that, you know, so Facebook is clearly there.
Oh, clearly there. They're big enough for it.
Well, and
it doesn't have to be any bigger.
And if you are not familiar with or practicing the activity of social selling, right? Like leveraging LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, etc. for lead generation, customer communication. If you're not doing that, then you're a dinosaur. And if you are doing that, then imagine the implications that we all debated back in the whole net neutrality question of, well, they wouldn't do that just for the sake of advantaging one company over a competitor in getting access to the infrastructure of the internet. Yes, they would, and yes, they did. I just read an article this morning about, you know, hey, look at this emerging technique of a vendor channel manager managing his channel partners with video on Facebook. And yeah, you can put some privacy and some community and some belonging boundaries around that for privacy questions. But imagine if somebody just came in and said, yeah, you're a competitor. I don't want you to be able to do that. Blink, and your messages disappear.
We're almost done with this, but I do want to bring it home to your clients and their willingness to advertise on Facebook, right? If they say, well, should we be marketing in a platform where the ads that show up around the edges are not necessarily, and the conversations that show up around the edges are not something over which we have enough control. And there's always a sense of, you know, I put an ad in a magazine, I don't know what article they're gonna have and whether it's pro my position or anti my position. But on Facebook, it's like, they're literally making decisions. No, sorry, this is an inappropriate thing to discuss at all on.
Well, and let's observe, and it's not like from a digital perspective, you have a lot of options. Because these companies have strangled the market to become, you know, duopolies at best. There really are, you know, only at the two maybe three players in digital marketing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and the marketing, the difference, if you've ever bought advertising, on the difference between Facebook and LinkedIn is night and day, right? Not just who you advertise to, but how you buy it, how you price it, where it gets placed. It's really quite dramatically different. All righty then. So topic number three, our continuing series on life after the pandemic. And we decided that one of the things we want to talk about is the emerging, I guess, the evolution of sales. We have to, you know, I do want to temper this. We always get carried away with life after pandemic as if things have changed and they will never change back. When in reality, most of it will mostly change back, but some of it will not. So,
well, it's hard to tell, and it's almost hard. It is hard to tell what, and that's, I think, some of the speculation. Right. But the one thing, you know, so the one thing that we know in the short term clearly is that sales patterns are changing. The thinking that went into this conversation was as we were warming up, we were talking about people that are getting used to the idea of selling without meeting. We've encountered people that are now having for the first time, they're selling entirely without having met. For some people, that this is not new at all. For some of us, right, have been doing selling for this way for a very long time. But I recognize that there's a whole, you know, group of people that are entering now that have never sold entirely online.
Well, and it's one thing if you're selling to a Fortune 500 company, like I never expect to actually go to their corporate headquarters.
Right.
But I'm selling to a company with, you know, 27 employees. They, in the past, have wanted me to come in, wander around, you know, stick my fingers on things and, you know, see what their server looks like.
Yes. Well, and this is the thing, right? This, I believe fundamentally that this will be one of the essential distinguishing factors, success versus not success post-pandemic, for any business, but especially for technology-based businesses, whether you are vendor side or channel partner side, your business will pivot, thriving versus barely surviving, more on the subject of how effectively you sell than it ever has before. That's not the first time I have said this. It is not, you know, as we've said previously, it's not a new trend. This is an accelerating trend, and one that I believe will be fundamentally altered post-COVID. Now, the difference here is you got to be very careful where you take your advice from, because everybody comes at this with a slant based on what their interest is on the back end, right? Now, if you read any of the opinions that have been written by folks that do digital marketing, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of brand names out there that do marketing automation and online, you know, campaigning and the tools, whether it's from the data side or the creative execution side, those folks will tell you, well, field sales has been dead forever and you're just barely catching up to the modern world, Grandpa, and you shouldn't have ever been doing field sales. And then there are people who run actual businesses and have in the SMB community for the last 30 years who will tell you there will always be a relationship component and you will always need to do this. What is unique and what is different is, can you do the field function remotely? I'm not talking about the difference between inside sales and field sales, relationship and prospecting and account development versus you know, quoting and pricing and all of the sales administration that's happening. I'm not talking about the job description. I'm talking about the essential function of meeting, engaging, and developing relationships with legitimate business decision makers without ever having had the privilege in this sales conversation, whether you've met them before or not. You know, you might know them previously, but in the course of this sales cycle, will you physically be in the same place as them? And I think you'll notice around the channel right now, Carl and I were joking about this, you know, it's been 25 years that he and I have been running a business in one shape or another, where that's the way we do it, right? Like, my territory has been either America or the world for the last 20 years, right? And I do 95%+ of my selling remotely, and I always have, but I know that's not the way most of the channel has done it. And when you talk to them now in the midst of COVID, that is a glaring pain point. Lots of people are struggling with how do you make that transition. It is not about the tools that you use, as with everything else. It's about the content. It's about the substance. Yes. Can you actually make humans go, well, I really like this guy and I think he's got some good ideas and I'd give him my money to do a thing without ever being physically present?
Right. And I think you've hit on what the key to that is that it's about the quality of the content and the quality of the interaction more so than anything else. And the tools don't really matter, you know, because don't get me wrong, I tend to favor video, I like the interaction personally, like, but that doesn't mean you can't do that on the phone. It doesn't mean you can't do it with an old fashioned letter. There are lots of ways to establish connection, lots of ways to establish value. It is about the content of the delivery, not the mechanism that you're using to do it.
Well, and my favorite sales technique has always been a roadmap type meeting where I sit down and say, so why am I here? Like, why did you call me in here today?
Right. Right. What am I doing?
Because clearly, you know, you've been getting my, you know, whatever, my newsletter for 5 years. Today, you decided to bring me in. Historically in small business, the owner has wanted me to come in and literally invited me into the office on the day that they need something.
Right.
I got to figure out what that is. And, you know, in some ways, I have a lengthy meeting followed by, you know, go sign me into the server and I'll poke around. But I think the important part was always in the meeting before I went and poked around, right? And so the question is, how do we do that today? How do you engage somebody and say, hey, you and me, Zoom, you know, let's hook this up. You know, we'll do a Zoom call. And maybe it will be easier to get that meeting than it has been in the past. But I think one of the things that's going to happen is I think you're going to see a play towards, we do this more securely than our competition. Because if you think about it, what's going to happen for the first time is you're going to be exposing to people who are not your clients. I have the ability to look inside your network and see all kinds of stuff that you can't even imagine, right? And I'm going to do it remotely, you know, but first you got to just click on this one thing. And if feel like ransomware. I don't know what does.
Because there are layers, right? Like anytime you're selling something, there's it. There's the thing you are selling. And then there is the way that you sell it, right? What we sell is infinitely more on show from a security point of view than it has ever been. Non-security people are paying attention to security and privacy and ransomware. Thank you. I think that's a very, very good.
Thank you.
But the way that we sell, I mean, you know, I will go all the way back to, you know, the good old fashioned days of Dale Carnegie and winning friends and influencing people. It is not what you say, it's how you say it. It's not what you're talking about. It's how you engage people in the process. It's don't talk about yourself. Ask questions about them, right? Interested is interesting, is the essence of building remote relationships over conference calls and cell phone calls and just emails for the last 20 years. I have been forced to learn if I can't be there and I'm competing with somebody that is there, I had better learn a way to elicit personal information, details, you know, the old fashioned, like, are you married? Do you have kids? What do you enjoy doing on the weekend? Who do you root for in the
circle? Right. I'll see your desk. Like, oh, is that a picture of your kid? Did you go fishing?
Mm-hmm. You got to do those essential things. But then there are elements that have to be adapted or exaggerated based on what we sell. Like if you were selling to me remotely pieces and parts like metal that I will bend in my metal bending shop, there's a certain amount of, you know, things that I need to know about you remotely. If you are selling remote access in the middle of the nighttime to my network and all my private data, I gotta hit, it takes more than a smile to make me trust you about things like that. We in the business of technology should have an advantage. Remote selling, right? We know how to use these tools, but we need to learn the human part, the interpersonal parts of, if you're asking for somebody to outsource a significant component of their business operation and cycle, the survival of the way they do their business is going to be with that guy in a little window in the corner of my monitor, and I will have never met him or really developed trust interpersonally. You're asking for a lot and you're doing it remotely. You really need to learn not just the technique of selling, but the psychology of
remote. You can tell we're all guys that work with our brains because you just described a metal bending shop. I would like to find the metal bending shop because I'd like to go in and just pay them to bend metal for me.
Oh, trust me, that's one of the fascinating things I learned working in the manufacturing industry. There are some things that they just do that they take for granted that I sit back and go, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Metal bending.
Hey, Ben. Well,
this podcast has been brought to you by Bob's Metal Bending.
Bob's Metal Bending. You know their IT provider is Jimmy Joe.
And I'm afraid that will do it for episode 59 of the
Killing It Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.